Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and this show is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network. Go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows. You can also find lots of other materials at the 1517 website, including blogs, books, speaker engagements, videos of past speaker engagements, there's just a lot of resources, and as we move forward, those are going to become more and more accessible throughout the year. So thank you for listening to The Thinking Fellows. We are in our fourth episode of the history of the Reformation, and we didn't make much progress as far as years go last episode, but that was intentional. We stopped at around 1520 in Luther's life in the last episode because 1521 is going to be very significant, and now we're going to actually backtrack and cover the same period of time we did in the last episode, but we're going to introduce a new quote-unquote character to the Reformation. And this is part of a plan because, you know, talking to Adam and Ra and Scott here, the plan is to do this very detailed, and we're going to do more than just Lutheran characters in the Reformation. We're going to branch out and try to give as complete picture of this time period as possible. And so, so we're going to add characters to the story as we go along. And the next, you know, the next big name on the roster is Philip Melanchthon. And we have done an episode or two or three or four on Melanchthon. And there's reason for that. Dr. Keith here is, I don't want to stroke his ego too much, he is one of the prominent Melanchthon scholars, in the U.S., not the world.
Oh, Lord.
And so what that means is that we can give Melanchthon some time that he doesn't seem to get other places, and people can actually learn about him. I mean, we've had people write into the show who have, you know, been pastors all their life and maybe heard say they're very thankful for the episodes we do on Melanchthon because they learned very little about him and things like that. So that's what we're going to do again today. So for some people, this might sound similar to episodes they've heard in the past, but I do want to note, we have, since the last time we did an episode on Melanchthon, we have over 2,000 new subscribers
to the show. That's a lot.
So this is not a waste of time to revisit this for people who are new to the show, people who are not Lutheran, and for Lutherans who still have yet really to experience sort of the development of Melanchthon's theology and his influence on the Reformation. So Dad, where do we begin here with Melanchthon? How far do you want to go back?
Well, I could, we were talking about Luther in 1520, and Adam went back to like 800 AD, so I won't go back that far.
How about when he was called Philip Schwarzfeld?
Schwarzschild.
Or Schwarzschild.
Okay, close.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, he's a, for those of the who listen, who's the sort of first time even hearing his name, he's a well known for multiple reasons. He's a colleague of Luther at the University of Wittenberg. Melanchthon is called to the university in 1518, and
he knows everybody.
Yeah, he knows,
not just in Wittenberg, but Europe.
He's more of what we'd call, at least initially, a humanist. He's known for studying the classical languages and classical literature, and for being part of the movement that seeks after a revival of that knowledge that's going on. He's connected to people like Erasmus and his great uncle or grand uncle or however you want to say it, Johannes Reuchlin, and others, even some of the humanists in Britain at the time. And he's a colleague of Luther. He teaches at the university often. I mean, there's some off because of small Caldic War and whatnot, but not for very long, from 1518 until his death in 1560. I mean, very long career there. Outlives Luther by 14 years, and teaches at the university that whole time.
I wonder if you might, just for the benefit of the listeners, talk more about what does it mean to be a humanist?
Yeah. So at the time, it's not the modern view of humanist would be kind of like a secular materialist thing, right? And that's not it at all. This is somebody who studies the humanities, right? This is somebody who's steeped in literature and in languages and in the documents of the past as much as possible. And in their time, regaining the knowledge from the past. Their cry is ad fontes, or return to the fountain, or return to the sources.
Uh-huh.
And this is a movement, and Adam's going to be better at this than me, but that you see all over Europe, that some scholars have argued has a particular persuasion in the north and a little bit different persuasion in the south.
And it's like the two movements are like two railroad rails.
Right.
In other words, they're running at the same time.
The Reformation and Renaissance.
Yes.
Yeah. And so this is a part of the Renaissance movement on the whole, but it's also in the church, right? There's a humanist movement in the church. It's sort of a biblical humanist movement within the church that seeks to recapture the study of the scriptures, and specifically the scriptures in the original languages, rather than medieval commentators on the scriptures or some such thing like that. But Melanchthon's part of this northern movement, which I, again, Adam, correct me, I think is fair to say is more characterized by a regaining of the study of classical literature, less than sort of like artistic and or architectural movements and whatnot in the south.
Yeah. Like northern Italy, primarily.
Yeah,
the humanism there is very different. That's I think Machiavelli,
right?
Back yeah, to Petrarch, and where it is ad fontes, but ad fontes in any number of directions. Whereas in the north, I think it's especially in those theological circles, it's directed going back to the source of the scriptures. And like in the case of like Zwingli in Switzerland, who's around this time, he's like early 1520s. What do the scriptures say to us about the church and its theology?
I think
it's pretty exclusively focused on that, as opposed to just wanting to know what Homer said. Like Petrarch writes these letters. He's
yes.
the father
yeah, yeah,
of the
yeah.
Renaissance.
But Melanchthon's very interested in what Homer said.
Sure.
And Cicero said.
Yeah.
But not so much so that he's going to write almost a love letter to him, right?
Oh,
oh really?
Okay. I don't know.
He's got
let's say that the thing that I think I left out that is maybe important. So, and again, Adam, really correct me if my assumptions are wrong here, but let's just say in the German states, humanism is very much more of a particularly Christian movement on the whole than it is farther south.
No, I think that's right.
And this is true too with Melanchthon, but one of the things that this movement is characterized by in the German estates too, and in northern parts, is that an attempt to find a reform of piety in the church. Mm. And so as they go back, they're looking not only for what were the correct teachings of the church in the past as expressed by Paul, but what is different now about the way we think we ought to live, as opposed to how they had it, say, in the early church, and let's get back to that. As one of the important things I think to know about even early Reformation is that Luther may stand there and say, why am I the only one that sees something wrong? But he's not the only one that sees something wrong. In fact, even his quote-unquote nemesis, Erasmus, thinks there's something wrong. He's just not coming to the same conclusion as Luther about what is wrong.
Well, yeah, almost every enemy of Luther does. I mean, even when we talk about the Radical Reformation, these are clearly people who, you know, we probably disagree with their conclusions and methodology and a whole lot of things, but they recognized, you know, the fault in the Roman Empire and the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, and Erasmus, let's just take Erasmus, for instance, at this time, he very much is interested in a reform of piety in the church, and the behavioral errors of the church of his time. I mean, that's about all, but he's very interested. I mean, he's got some personal reasons why that might be the case. You know, his own parentage is not wonderful. And,
right.
You know, there's some reasons for this, and that's, you know, for instance, priests having children with their maids, quote unquote, is not an uncommon thing. You know, Luther says, Nestingen's famous for saying that when Luther got to the University of Wittenberg, he was famous for commenting that he couldn't cross the street without tripping over a syphilitic monk, you know, and that this was just the case. Now, one of the interesting differences, I think, from Melanchthon to Luther is that Melanchthon, upon getting to Wittenberg, very much signs on with the theological reform of the church, but he really doesn't shake completely all of this humanist
Restoration of virtue.
Restoration of virtue in the church. He doesn't really shake that. Mm. And that's just something that Luther is not ever concerned with in the same way.
Mm-hmm. And important.
It causes for Melanchthon's theology, especially, you know, as he becomes, as I'd say, maybe a more mature theologian in the 1530s, it causes his theology to be colored in a slightly different way than Luther's is. And to many people, that slight difference in coloring becomes very noticeable. Mm-hmm. You know, Luther's painting in green, all of a sudden Melanchthon comes out with, you know, purple. And it looks, you can see it's different. But anyway, that's what he is as a humanist. He studies, and Melanchthon particularly is an expert in ancient languages.
And Luther valued him beyond measure.
Yeah, and seems to have had an extreme ability in languages. I mean, when I teach on Melanchthon, I like pointing out that he's born in 1497, and that he gets his bachelor's degree in 1511. So he's 14 years old. He graduates college at 14 years old. He does that at the University of Heidelberg, which is interesting because later on he's involved with the reforming of the curriculum at that school. But he applies right away to their master's program, and they don't take him because he's a little young and uppity. He ends up going. I imagine he probably was a little young and uppity, actually. He ends up going to the University of Tübingen, and he studies, gets a master's degree there, basically in the same thing with an expansion. I mean, he's studying ancient literature and ancient languages. That's his thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But particularly in Melanchthon's case, Greek and Latin.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, he goes to Tübingen, kind of the same thing. He adds on there. He studies a little bit of law. He studies a little astronomy, astrology. He studies a little bit of mathematics, so on and so forth. But he gets his Master of Arts degree in 1514. Again, born 1497, so that means he's 17 years old when he receives a master's degree. He begins to teach a little bit there, or I guess we'd say teach. I mean, the formal designation for him there, he's not called to be a professor. He's a lecturer. Maybe we'd think adjunct. He's a lecturer there, and he does that for a while, for 3 years or so. He writes, this is so funny, at the age, I think he was 19, at the age of 19, he writes a Greek grammar for people learning, you know, who are German speakers learning Greek, ancient Greek. He writes a Greek grammar at the age of 19, and it's used to teach Greek to students in Germany for about 100 years. That's the like primary textbook in Greek grammar. I always think that's why he's famous in Germany, is for that kind of thing. He's famous in Lutheran circles for his connection to Lutheran Reformation.
Well, also a preceptor of Germany.
Right, he establishes the German grade school and high school program. He reformats the universities. But he's famous for his contribution to education in Germany. But he goes to Wittenberg in 1518. He is called there as professor of Greek. And that's his job. He's single salary, professor of Greek. He meets Luther. He's much more enamored with Luther at first meeting than Luther is of him. Luther notes that his appearance is that he's small, and I think we'd say mousy.
Mm-hmm.
And that he looks sickly all the time, and that he doesn't spend enough time in sun, you know, out in daylight. I always get the picture of like a mole, you know, mole man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he, so then before he goes to Wittenberg, is he familiar with the disputations of Luther that were happening? Well, it would be happening during his sort of educate, like the latter end of his education, right?
Yeah, he is familiar. In fact, he goes to Wittenberg. This is kind of funny because his great uncle Reuchlin, who's his educational patron at this point, since the death of Melanchthon's father and grandfather, his mother's uncle, who was a famous humanist, stepped up to be his patron in education, not paying for it because his father was wealthy, as was his grandfather, so his education was taken care of. But as far as guidance goes, he was his educational patron. And Reuchlin is a famous Hebraist and humanist himself. And when Melanchthon doesn't get into the program at Heidelberg, contacts at Tübingen, and gets him in not gets him in, but contacts the administration there, because that's, to begin, was a bastion of humanist learning for many years at that point. And Melanchthon goes there, but then when Melanchthon doesn't get a call right off the bat to one of the universities, Reuchlin sort of works through back channels to get him the call to Wittenberg, because Reuchlin wants him next to Luther, because Reuchlin's very aware of Luther and what Luther's doing theologically, and very aware of his great nephew's interest in theology, via the Greek New Testament, and gets him there, because at this early stage in the game, 1518, the humanists see Luther as a friend.
Yep.
And an ally. That he's going after the same things they're going after. So Reuchlin trusting Luther enough to sort of take over the educational, future educational pursuits of Melanchthon at the university was big. Now, later on, the fact that Melanchthon doesn't disavow Luther's teaching causes Reuchlin to disown Melanchthon, even though Reuchlin's the one that sent him there. He had willed to him his Reuchlin's considerable library upon his death, and when later on, after the papal bull, after 1521, when Melanchthon doesn't disavow Luther, Reuchlin rescinds all that. So, and specifically after the writing of the Bondage of the Will, too, that was huge. I mean, that the writing of the Bondage of the Will and the way that Luther treats Erasmus in the Bondage of the Will really causes a rift between the humanists and
Luther.
And to be honest, it causes a bit of a rift between Luther and Melanchthon. Now, some anti-Melanchthon scholars will argue that it was Luther's theology in Bondage of the Will that caused Melanchthon to be uncomfortable with it. But in my reading, that's just not the case. There are letters of Melanchthon where Melanchthon specifically states that it's the way that Luther treated Erasmus in their Bondage of the Will, and specifically that he called him names in the Bondage of the Will, that he absorbed, it seems to have lowered himself to ad hominem attacks of Erasmus in the writing of the Bondage of the Will that really turned Melanchthon on the way that Luther communicated with people, which was very...
He's the wild boar in the vineyard.
He was the wild boar in the vineyard, yeah. And so I forgot what I was supposed to be talking about.
Well, I mean...
Good stuff.
Basically, his early arrival at Wittenberg, which is going to bring with it writing. So we'll probably hop into 1521 in Melanchthon's life now, and we'll go to 1521 in Luther's life in the next episode, because that's pretty substantial for Luther as well. But for Melanchthon, it's substantial for a different reason, and it's probably okay to hop there unless there's anything...
Well, no, I think we should back up if you let me decide.
Yeah, I'm letting you decide this up.
So 1518, he's called there as a professor of Greek, right? They have this initial... Luther's a little put off by him. They get to know each other very quickly. They become fast friends. In fact, so much so that Melanchthon travels with Luther to the Leipzig disputation.
That's 19, right?
Yeah. But just as accompanying him, not really contributing to it at all. But Melanchthon becomes so interested in what's going on theologically at Wittenberg that he desires to teach theology. And is essentially told, I've suffered from this a couple times, that he's not qualified to do that. In other words,
hasn't received holy orders.
Yeah, he doesn't have the right papers to teach theology. And so his initial workaround to that is, well, that's fine, I'm called to be professor of Greek, so I'll simply teach the students Greek by virtue of teaching them the Gospel of John in Greek, right? And so that's his initial workaround. But eventually he's convinced to take a Bachelor of Divinity degree or a Bachelor of Theology degree. For the modern listener, think more in terms of a Master's of Divinity degree, but an odd one that you could receive by virtue of writing a dissertation, essentially. And so he writes a theological dissertation that's examined by the faculty, and he's examined by the faculty, and he receives a Bachelor of Theology degree, which then entitles him to, or qualifies him to teach theology at the university. right around 1520, well, 1519 in that baccalaureate thesis is where imputation in the Reformation is first, I always say reused because, of course, the Apostle Paul.
Bible word.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Reused to describe simple man's justification before a holy God, right? That this occurs because Christ's righteousness is imputed.
Yep.
To the
reckoned
believer.
Reckoned to,
right? And that's the first time that's used in Lutheran, and it becomes the dominant way that Lutherans speak of justification, if not the 100% dominant way Lutherans speak of justification by virtue of our confessional language, which, interestingly enough, later on, Melanchthon also writes.
Yep.
Okay, so this is a theme that he gets on early. Luther is is constantly worried about Melanchthon, which is interesting because Luther himself is sick quite a bit. But Melanchthon is sickly all the time, and Luther worries about this. And in 1520, essentially arranges a marriage between Melanchthon and the daughter of the mayor of Wittenberg, Catherine von Krapp, or Catherine Krapp, which Melanchthon was hesitant to acquiesce to, stating and arguing with Luther over and over again that he's not fit to be married, and that she's a very lovely lady, and that she surely wouldn't accept him because she's worthy of a far better man. They do get married. They have many children. They have a very happy marriage. They're never reported to argue as much as Martin and Katie and all this other stuff of the very like hailed marriage of Martin and Katie. By all accounts, Melanchthon was a very happily married man his entire life, and even though he was reluctant to get married, on his deathbed, one of the two things he said is, "I can't wait to see my dear wife again." But Luther, in right around this same time, because Melanchthon is teaching Greek and wants to teach theology, he does this incredibly selfless thing that I'm not ever aware he did for himself. He goes to the elector and argues that Melanchthon receive a double call to the university as professor of Greek and professor of theology, and that not only does he receive a double call, but that that extra teaching load provides him a double salary. And from that point on, I think it's 1520, might be 1521, from that point on, Melanchthon receives a double salary at the university from that point for the rest of his life. For teaching the two things. That's because Luther wouldn't argue for it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But to me, that's amazing. And I'm not aware that anyone ever did that for Luther, because he certainly taught more than just what he taught, right?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Was it to keep him there? Or?
No, it was because he was starting a family and he was broke. He was starting a family. I mean, other things happen for Luther. Eventually he's given the black cloister. He's given this giant house and all this other stuff. Luther gets married later, too, and it's, but I always sort of find that pretty touching, that Luther would be willing to go and argue that the elector give twice as much money as he needed to have this young pup here, this young gun here. And Luther saw him as a young gun. I mean, for sure. Luther saw him as this guy. Give me the ammunition that we need.
Right. And when the Loci was first published, Luther said it was like a book let down from heaven itself.
When they're sitting, and then I'll let you take me wherever you want to go, but when they're sitting and they're talking about translating the Bible into German, it's obvious that Melanchthon will be the key figure in Greek, because it's just, he's been studying Greek and Latin since he was 9 years old. And it's obvious that he's the guy to go to for the Greek sections. But Luther, being an Old Testament scholar, is better at Hebrew than Melanchthon. And so they kind of strike up this deal that, Melanchthon, you teach me Greek, and I'll teach you Hebrew, and we'll go from here. And Luther says the inequity of their arrangement became obvious when, after 2 weeks, Melanchthon didn't need his help in Hebrew anymore and was actually teaching him things about Hebrew he'd never considered. whereas Luther's still, working through the basics of grammar in Greek after 2 weeks. And he's in that way, he's an amazing character. I can't even imagine what his ability in languages must have been like.
Probably would have been frustrating if you were having to read alongside him. I mean, I think I mean, this is just
for you.
Total speculation on that. Thanks, Adam.
I was taking a drink.
This is total speculation on my part, but I think one of the reasons it's harder or he is less studied is if you are going to read original Melanchthon or translate him, you have to be very capable in both Greek and Latin because he just switches between them mid-sentence.
And it's not Koine that he's going into.
No, yeah. And there's a couple sections that I've read where he like implies you aren't educated enough to be teaching theology if you can't read these Greek words like mixed into his
life. His famous line from his treatise on the Loci method is that any person who wants to be, paraphrase, any person who first wishes to be a theologian must first master being a grammarian, or what he's saying is an exegete. So if you want to do systematics, you got to learn exegesis. You can't do systematics without any ability in the languages. In fact, for Melanchthon, he would have thought you'd need to have a very competent ability in languages.
It's interesting Luther has this high view of Melanchthon so early on. The thing that keeps sticking out in my mind is when Luther is whisked away to the Wartburg in translating the New Testament, he gets this letter from Melanchthon about these prophets, the Zwickau prophets who have come in there, and he asks them, what do I do with them? Mm-hmm. A guy that Luther's already certified as being a good theologian, but Melanchthon's always deferring to Luther when it comes to these sort of real practical, if you will, questions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is it because you mentioned earlier, Luther recognizes that in Melanchthon, while he's a genius, he maybe lacks the practical experience. But there's a lot. I mean, the future is sort of...
He's a genius, but he's a kid, too, in a lot of ways. I mean, he's not a kid, but Luther, I think, is... my PhD's not in math. Was he 14 years? 1483 to 1497. He's 14 years
older
mm-hmm. than Melanchthon.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of experience that comes in that 14 years for Luther as a dynamic character. And to be clear, Melanchthon's never the dynamic leadership character that Luther is ever. Even as an old man, he's not.
Yeah. And some of it would be like, imagine the youngest, somebody could be holding a PhD coming into a department for the first time and taking, charge. That would be interesting.
In a department in a turbulent time, in a turbulent university, and then the elder statesman is off and gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and then a bunch of crazies come in, and they're like, we're going to take over. And I think it's fairly natural that he's saying, geez, what do I don't know what to do with these cats. And it's interesting. I mean, he's not Luther, and this is one of the great things about him is he's just not Luther. All the strengths that we attribute to Luther, we ought never attribute to Melanchthon.
Yeah,
like the sort of bold character to stand up and say, "Here I stand," you know, because I can do nothing else. Maybe Melanchthon would say that. But
he'd probably say, here I edit.
It's almost like you needed both of them.
Yeah.
I don't want to use this, but like a yin and yang, right? You got the bold Luther, and then you've got the very cautious, reasoned Melanchthon.
Right, who's going to I think it's funny, can I edit? Who's going to rework things until he has it his mind exactly
right. He's
the
systematician, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, eventually, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And that's where we're getting a transition for... I think the next, you know, third of this episode, the last third of this episode is, so for 1521 now rolls around from Melanchthon, and what's substantial about this in the Melanchthon timeline here is this is going to be the year where the first systematic theology of the Reformation is published.
Yeah, so that is interesting, because what happens is Melanchthon ends up giving a series of lectures on the Book of Romans. And he's going through it. If there's any sort of old LBI people in our audience, kind of think he's going through it like via the inductive Bible study method. Right?
Yes.
So he goes through it through a wide sweeping sort of 30,000 foot view lecture. And then he comes back at it and they go chapter by chapter, verse by verse through it. And he's doing the Loci method in this. He's like pulling it out. common words and categories of sin and grace and justification. And he's pulling out and he's explaining all of these and from the Greek and the whole nine yards. And his students are enamored by this. I mean, it was said that there was never, that Luther's lectures were always standing room only, but that Melanchthon spilled out into the hallways at the height of student enrollment at the University of Wittenberg. And that his students are enthralled by this and have never heard anything like what he's doing, even from Luther's lectures, where it's just, this is explained so thoroughly and so topically and so, quote-unquote, systematically, right? Because we don't have a category for systematic theologies at this point. You can take Aquinas and whatnot and Lombard sentences, but that's a little bit different than what he's doing. And so they take their notes and they put them together and they run them down to the printer in Wittenberg and they publish them without asking. And they call it literally like Philip Melanchthon's Topics of Theology, or and he
didn't sign a waiver or anything.
No, and he's horribly upset when he sees it. He's very upset when he sees
That'd be like a student now recording your lecture without telling you and then throwing it up on YouTube.
Right.
Yeah, I think that'd be parallel.
Yeah.
That's happened to me.
And so he takes...
I know somebody else that something like that's happened to too.
I would say every class I took at Concordia the first day started with, you may not record this without my permission.
Oh, I never said that.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't say that. I don't care. Oh. Record anything I say. I mean, look at everything I'm saying now is being recorded. If I'm wrong,
I used to ask that at liberal Lutheran seminary, and I knew why they said no.
Well, yeah. They didn't want it getting out.
Yep. Well, I think in CUI it's in the syllabus because the university technically owns the lecture.
Yeah.
Yeah, or something like that.
They don't own me. Okay. So he gets a hold of this. He literally buys a copy, runs it over to Luther and says, have you seen this? And he's just indignant, and he's expecting Luther to...
I love how he had to buy a copy of his own book.
Yeah. Runs Luther, have you seen this? And Luther says, yeah, I've seen it. It's great. What are you so upset about? I mean, it's like, Luther's like, this is the best thing I've seen all year. This is amazing. And Melanchthon sort of, you know, deflated a little bit, says, well, I'm not happy with it. It's not what I would have wanted it to be to go out to the masses. And so he reworks it again, and that he is then published under this long Latin title that just means by candlelight, because he basically... He wrote it by candlelight in the library at night, trying to correct what he saw as not accurate about the student notes, which he's also then not happy with, and reworks by 1521 into what we have as the Loci Communis Theologici, or the Common Topics of Theology.
Of the year 21?
1521, yeah, which is when that's officially published. There's this by candlelight version, which is very similar to the 1521. Loci is coming out in 1520. 1521, the Loci itself first comes out. And this is the first Protestant systematic theology, which makes it the first, of course, Lutheran systematic theology. And in many ways, the first systematic theology that's approached in a specific way like this. I mean, not like Thomas Aquinas, of course, that's, the Summa, that's a systematic theology in a way, but not in the same way that this is, where it's set up literally as a teaching book for the education of pastors. I mean, that's the intent of this thing. And it goes, but the unique thing about the 1521 edition is it still follows the original skeletal outline as his lecture on Romans. Mm-hmm. And so it's organized in such a way that it follows sort of the methodology that Paul uses in the book of Romans instead of a more classical or creedal methodology where you're starting with
God the Father,
or even, God the Father as creator and the creation account and kind of going on from there to other things. It very much follows Paul's approach of, sin. We all know we're sinners, people of the book, people of without the book, they're without an excuse, justification.
To the observing eye, if you take his later editions of the Loci and compare it to 1521, the first thing that should stand out, if you just open the table of contents, is that the opening doctrine in this one is sin, and the opening doctrine in the later editions is God.
Yeah.
Why the change?
Go ahead.
Well, that's, I mean, I have about 280 pages written on that. Okay. But I mean, the reality of why the change is I think, somewhat complicated, but I think it is the Aristotelian influence. And the later Melanchthon, the humanist roots run deeper than the earlier Melanchthon. And so his constant, he's constantly, well, first of all, we could barely handle the number of sort of sub-editions that he has of this 1521. He's a consummate tinkerer. And so, I mean, there's edition after edition after edition after. I mean, every year he's changing it a little bit. I mean, it's like if you were tracking a book, it'd be on the 35th printing or something like that, because he's making all these changes.
That's why we have in our cornerstones at Lutheran parishes, the unaltered Lutheran
Augsburg Confession, the UAC.
AC, unaltered, because he was always tinkering with it as if it was his document.
But
by the way, how does the timing of this compare with Luther, with Calvin doing the Institutes?
So this is earlier at this point, especially if you take
the 40s,
right? Yeah, well, if you take the sort of the known edition of the Institutes,
I believe it's small when 15, it began.
Yeah, I think it's 1541.
Okay,
so that would set this early set of Melanchthon's Loci almost 20 years prior to that. Now there are earlier editions of the Institutes, but if you sort of say this is the known edition of the Institutes that people read, the in English, the Ford Lewis Battles translation and the Library of Christian Classics.
Yep.
I believe that's 1541.
Okay. Thanks.
Whereas this, I mean, somebody should fact check me on that. I think that's what it is. I haven't read it in probably 15 years, so somebody should probably check me on
that. The notes in front of me say 1541.
Okay. But so this is 1521, and this is the best-known edition, I'd say, to this day of Melanchthon's Loci. This is also the one that's in the Christian Classics library, the 1521. So if you're kind of doing apples-to-apples there of the known, because in that collection, they put the more known editions of every particular work that had multiple editions.
Well, this one's, out of all the editions, this is shorter than the later editions. He adds on ordering.
This is much shorter content than later
editions. I mean, as an English book, it's less than 100 pages on its own. The edition I have is only over 100 pages because of translator's preface and all this.
Connected to the Bucer.
Yes. And so it's not very long. Like, doctrines are summed up in like anywhere between 3 and 10 English pages. So
as the sort of grand thing for the Melanchthon, the would-be Melanchthon scholar, Melanchthon introduces the world to his reliance on the Loci method in this. And once you see that in Melanchthon, it's difficult to unsee as he writes, say, the Augsburg Confession or the Apology or later editions of the Loci or later editions of anything, really. And it's also difficult to unsee the influence of his utilization of this topical-oriented method on later Lutheranism, including the Formula of Concord, various our dogmatics from this point on for several hundred years are, follow this method. Are even called Loci.
Chemnitz uses the same method. Chemnitz has Locis as well. He has common topics of theology.
Yeah, well, as later, as do 17th century Lutheran systematicians.
Yeah. So that's important. I think unless you have anything else in this early period for him, I think we're at a good space in time. To start wrapping up.
We made 2 years progress.
I mean,
today. 1519. That's good.
Well, and again, emphasizing sort of the slow pace of this. This is because we're doing things that we haven't done on the show before. So to transition into next episode, we got to 1521 with Melanchthon. We only got to 1520 with Luther in the last 2 weeks. Next week, 1521 with Luther is going to be important because of the Diet of Worms, or the Diet of Worms, depending on who you are. And
Worms.
Yeah. And that's a big, why that happens and what happens after that is going to be big. So we have to kind of go a year at a time. But I think after this, after the mid-1520s, there's going to be some big jumps. We're obviously going to have, if we're following documents that kind of change the course of things, or even the people who change the course of things, we're going to have to make some bigger jumps. So, yeah, we're going slow.
Not much bigger. Getting the Visitation article is not too much after that. Catechism.
Well, and the fallout, too, with all the
So maybe not. Maybe we are going to crawl a year at a time.
Yeah. Oh,
we have to.
I mean, this early Reformation, making big jumps will be difficult if you're trying to take events because there's a lot year to year. Early Reformation is packed with just like monumental things happening.
Yeah, which is, I mean, brings up a point we've talked about on other episodes about it gets kind of weird when people start trying to contrast the early and the later Reformation or the early and the late Luther, especially as we go slowly through this, you just see how much of sort of the Reformation idea is pushed onto this front end that is looks like it's going to be clarifications, in Melanchthon's case, some concessions. Like it's going to be peacemaking after sort of the boar has torn up the vineyard.
Well, yeah, and I think, I don't know, I actually don't, this sounds silly, but don't know what the exact plan is, but part of this, if you're continuing with Luther, has to be his translation of the Bible. And that's one that, you know, is, I think, often overlooked in this, but was seen by him to be one of the most significant things he'd ever done.
Many scholars sum it up by saying he formed the German language that.
Yeah.
No, you're right. So this is, I mean... One of the genius things about doing something like this is that we're not going to run out of episode topics anytime soon.
See how you could.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to this episode. We really do hope you stick around for this. If you have questions as you listen to this, feel free to shoot them over to me. And if we can maybe take a break, you know, after five or six episodes in to sort of sum up any questions of things people think we might have missed, I'll go ahead and try to take the opportunity to do that as well. So yeah, please send in your questions. Thank you for your support of the Thinking Fellows. 2019 is going to be a big year for us and looking to make, you know, the podcast network financially sustainable for the future. So if this has been a benefit to you, please consider partnering with us financially. You can go to 1517.org. There's a donate button at the top. It's on all the pages there too. So if you go straight to the podcast page, you'll be able to access it as well. Thanks for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.